Whereas Brahma and Shiva faithfully engage in service to the Supreme Lord, Vishnu is the Supreme Lord himself, and therefore his activities of maintaining the brahmanas and religious principles, as mentioned in this verse, Dvija Dharma Setu, are not occupational duties but lila. So in addition to being a guna avatar, Vishnu is also a lila avatar, according to Srila Jiva Goswami. The Mahabharata, Shanti Parva, describes the birth of Lord Brahma from the lotus flower emanating from Vishnu and the subsequent birth of Lord Shiva from the angry eyes of Lord Brahma. Vishnu, however, is the self-manifested personality of Godhead who enters the material universe by his own internal potency, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 3.8.15. Taloka padmam sa ueva Vishnu pravavishat sarva gunavabhasam. In conclusion, Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the Supreme Controller whose personal form is full of eternal existence, knowledge, and bliss, who is beginningless but is the beginning of everything, who is known as Govinda, and who is the original cause of all causes, as stated in Brahma Sanhita. Still, that same eternal Lord manifests himself as Brahma and Shiva in the sense that the primeval controllers, Brahma and Shiva, manifest the potency and supreme will of the Lord, although they themselves are not supreme. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshuri Nilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Creation, maintenance, and destruction. So these are eternal factors of the material world, material energy. And they're produced by the three modes of material nature. There are at least three different descriptions of creation in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And We hear in the context of those descriptions of the creation how the three modes of material nature are agitated by the time factor. And then everything begins to happen. We can see the logic with these modes. It makes a lot of sense that you have, for action, to get something to happen, there has to be passion, the mode of passion. Every action is instigated by passion. It's the active, the energy that gets things moving. Activity starts. Actually, this translation today, it ended. It says, living beings are always subject to the forces of creation, maintenance, and destruction. So we see this principle of creation, maintenance, and destruction manifested in all aspects of existence in the material world, on the macrocosmic and the microcosmic, on the universal scale, and of course in our own lives. So to get things going, you get the mode of passion. So that in the context of the universe, we have Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma sometimes also becomes a little infected because he's so closely associated with the mode of passion. And Brahma, of course, he creates. Brahma is so exalted. We often hear in the Bhagavatam when the demigods are in trouble, they go to Lord Brahma. The demigods, they're tiny compared to Lord Brahma. Even and of course, in comparison to Lord Shiva. For example, Brahma's life, we know how long Lord Brahma's life is. Here, he's not the supreme, but some people may think he's the supreme because he's so far beyond everyone else within this material universe. First of all, he's a creator, so he gets everything going. He uses the materials that Krishna has given, or Lord Vishnu has given, but he makes it all happen. But his life is so long. You know, on the day of Brahma, there are 14 manus in each day of Brahma. So these manus, there are 1,000 chatur yugas in the day of Brahma. So each manu rules for like 72 chatur yugas. So each one of these periods of a manu, that's as long as, for example, Indra serves. Every time there's a change of manus, there are different positions that are filled. And one of those positions is the Indra. So there are 14 Indras in a day of Brahma. So just consider the difference between Indra and Brahma. There are 14 Indras in one day of Brahma, and he lives 311 trillion years, well, of our years, but 100 of his own years. So Brahma is way up there. There's a verse in the second canto that says, in the matter of creation, Lord Brahma has a brain exactly like the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Interesting the way Prabhupada translated it. He has a brain like God's in the creation of the material world. So Brahma is connected with the mode of passion. And then, so passion gets things going. You add that passionate energy gets things going. And then there's maintenance. Things have to calm down a little bit, you might say. Can't, just like people, some people are very hectic. They can start a lot of things, but they don't follow through and nothing gets finished. It has to be maintenance. You have to kind of calm down. So the mode of goodness is the maintenance stage, which is taken over by Lord Vishnu. He's the only one that can handle that job. That's the hardest job. Keeping everything going, maintaining. And here it's said in this purport that he's not associated with the material mode of goodness. Everything he does is transcendental. Therefore, it's lila. Of course, that's an important point that's being made in this purport today. In the first canto of the Bhagavatam, it's one of the names of Lord Vishnu is Amogha Lila. And that name is given in connection with the creation. Amogha means spotless or sinless. So sometimes people think that, well, the creation is not, it's sinful, it's a bad thing. And so much suffering goes on here and so on. People criticize God or say there's no God because of the suffering here. But the first canto of the Bhagavatam says, no, even his creation is Amogha. Even that lila, it's a lila. Everything he does is lila. Because he doesn't have to do anything. That's the basic idea of lila. He has no responsibility. It's not his job. It's Brahma's job to create the universe. It's Shiva's job to destroy it. It's not Vishnu's job to maintain it. He does it because he wants to. He likes it. He likes everything he does. That's God. It's like I was listening to a lecture by Radhika Raman Prabhu, Ravi Gupta. He was saying he often asks people when he gives public lectures, what do you think that a person would do if they didn't have anything to do? Or what would you do if you didn't have to do anything? And they would say, well, I would just play, just have fun, basically, vacation all the time. So that's what Krishna does. That's what God does. What do you think God does? You think he has a job? You think he has to punch a clock? No, he does whatever he feels like doing. So in the maintenance of this world, that's also fun for him, somehow or other. Yeah. Of course, it's not, you know, Krishna's having fun in another way. But he can have fun in so many different ways at the same time. So even his maintenance of the material world, which is difficult, actually, for him it's not difficult. Everything is lila. Lilaya actually means easy. It's easy for him to do it. So then finally, of course, we have Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva destroys ignorance. We can see how ignorance destroys things. Just like if there's no maintenance, you just let things go. What happens? Everything goes to hell, falls apart, disintegrates. We have to be careful in our own lives that the mode of ignorance doesn't enter and destroy. We're trying to maintain, just like Prabhupada told us, to maintain what I've given you. So if ignorance enters, then things start to fall apart because that energy of maintenance has to be there. Then destruction, everything is finished. Like one of the, in Bhagavad Gita, we learn that intoxication is connected with the mode of ignorance. So what happens with intoxication? Destruction. People destroy their lives. Or they take so much intoxication, they pass out. Another kind of destruction. No more activity, just a stupor. So Lord Shiva is connected with that mode of material nature. So I want to mention a few things in the word for word that I found interesting. There's a phrase here. Sapvadivi stiti layabhava. Excuse me, layodbhava. So there are three things here: stiti, laya, and udbhava. I'm missing something here. Yeah, udbhava is the creation. The order is different here, actually. It has maintenance, destruction, and creation. So stiti is maintenance, laya is destruction, and udbhava is creation. Or creation is also sometimes given as srishti. Usually you hear it srishti. That's the way it's given in Brahma Samhita. Srishti, stiti, and pralaya. So these three things. Srishti, stiti, and pralaya. So stiti, I want to mention a little something about this word. Stiti, we have in Sanskrit this syllable sta. Sta means, we have it, so many English words that begin with sta that have to do with the same idea. Sta means stable, stay, stabilize, stationary, and so on. Stasis, ecstasy, actually, the root of it. When you're out of that stability, ecstasy. So all of these have to do with sta. So the stiti means with maintenance, when things are stable. And in the Nectar of Devotion, we hear about, you get stay, also the word stay. So we have stayi bhava. If you have a hard time remembering all the different bhavas, what they mean, well, stayi means to stay. Stayi bhava is your main one, we can say, whether your parenthood and friendship and servitude and conjugal love. So these are the ones that you stay in all the time. That's your main bhava. So that's called stayi bhava. How do you can remember it? Stayi, stay. So all these stiti, all of these words that begin with this st, and so many English words come from this. Actually, there's so many Sanskrit English words that come from Sanskrit. It's amazing. So anyway, there's this one. And then this laya or pralaya. Pralaya, it's often called pralaya. The prefix pra just kind of expands the meaning. You may know that from the first verse of the Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada points out, he quotes Vishwanath, or refers to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, commenting on this verse, the second verse, excuse me, dharma projita, I'm just talking about the prefix pra, dharma projita kaitavotra. So it could say dharma ujita kaitavotra. So ujita means to kick out. Kick out what? The Bhagavatam kicks out kaitava dharma, or cheating religion. But as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out, because it says pra-ujita or projita, so the cheating dharma is not only karmakanda, things for ordinary material sense gratification in this world, but it includes the desire for liberation. So that's the significance of those three little letters, pra. So you get, instead of ujita, you get projita. That's why Prabhupada makes that point, that kicking out also the desire for liberation. So then there's also laya. Laya is in the ashta sattvika vikara, the transformations of ecstasy in Vishuddha Sattva, in the pure mode of goodness, in the bhava stage. So the last one is called laya, or sometimes pralaya also. The point I was going to make about pra is that kind of expands the meaning. The final devastation is pralaya. Pralaya payo dijale ditavanasi vedam. That verse about Mina Avatar. So it talks about the pralaya. So laya or pralaya is also the final of the eight ecstasies. And it's sometimes described as devastation or destruction or fainting also. It's called fainting. So I just wanted to read a little something here. This is from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this third verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a line, rasam alayam. The third verse of the Bhagavatam tells us to pibata bhagavatam rasam alayam muhudaho rasika bhubhipavakaha. So the first three verses of the Bhagavatam are spoken by, their Vyasadeva is basically introduction to the whole Bhagavatam. Then at the fourth verse, then he introduces the sages of Naimisharanya and the meeting at Naimisharanya. So the first three are like an invocation, glorification of the Bhagavatam, giving us an idea of what the subject of the Srimad Bhagavatam is. From the third verse, we're told, drink the nectar, because the Bhagavatam is the ripe fruit of the Vedic literature. So drink the fruit. It says this fruit has no seed and no pulp, or no skin, it's only pulp. So how do you eat such a fruit? Well, you drink it. Be with the Bhagavatam. Relish. Prabhupada translates it as relish the Bhagavatam. So this is part of the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. He says, the word, and Prabhupada translates alayam. It says rasam alayam. So layam, again, I'm talking about this word layam. So alayam means until liberation or even in a liberated condition. You can drink the nectar. In other words, you don't stop when you're liberated. You don't merge into Brahman and then stop hearing Krishna Katha. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, how should the fruit be consumed? That is explained. One should drink it. For this fruit is the essence of taste. Rasam. So we're talking about the Bhagavatam here. One should drink it. For this fruit is the essence of taste. Rasam. Devoid of skin, seed, and other objectionable parts. Laya means liberation. Sayujya. Or attaining the conditions of Salokya, Sarshti, Samipya, and Sarupya. The word alayam then means that the fruit extends beyond these types of liberation, because Bhagavatam is famous for glorifying the Lord's pastimes. Now this part I like this. Or laya can refer to the eighth sattvika bhava called pralaya, fainting. One should drink until one develops the eight symptoms up to the final one, fainting. Though one will not be able to drink the nectar when one has fainted, when the fainting wears off, one again awakens to consciousness and begins drinking until one faints again. One cannot give up drinking. Thus the word muhur continuously is used. This is an example of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, his commentary, especially on the first, well, all of his commentaries are amazing, but the first three verses of the Bhagavatam. On the first verse, he gives five different commentaries. And he even says, this is the first explanation, this is the second explanation. And they get progressively more intimate. It starts with describing the material world and how this verse is a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra and that kind of thing. And then at the end, you're hearing about Radha Krishna Leela and the fifth explanation. So it's amazing. And he explains each word. Now this word can be taken this way and so on. So it's legitimate, basically, what he's saying. It's legitimate. You can see the Bhagavatam. Because the Bhagavatam is Krishna. Krishna is a multifaceted jewel. So you can look at the jewel in different ways and see different things. And he can reveal himself also. The Bhagavatam is Krishna appearing before us. There's a night in the very first verse, in his commentary on the first verse of the Bhagavatam, Sridhar Swami, in the last line, I won't quote the fairly long verse, but the last line he says that it is, I'm forgetting the Sanskrit word, but it says it's easily obtained, sulabha. He says the Bhagavatam, he talks about how wonderful it is, and then he says it's sulabha. It means it's very easy to get, all you have to do is crack open the book, read Srimad Bhagavatam, and you get access to all this treasure, all this nectar, all this rasa. So, and so many different tastes. When you read through the Bhagavatam, for me, I have a hard time sometimes understanding how is this all leading up to the 10th canto? Is it taking me up there gradually, step by, especially when you get to the 9th canto, there's some really far up. There's a whole chapter about human sacrifice. So what is this doing in the 9th canto? Somehow it's there for a reason. There's a reason behind it. But still, what you find in the Bhagavatam is there's so much variety, actually. There's so many different tastes. There are so many different tastes there in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's another thing you can say about that fruit of the Bhagavatam. It has a variety of tastes, infinite variety of tastes. Again, because it's Krishna himself. So even the creation of this material world, because it's Krishna's Leela, we're supposed to hear about it. It's so important that we hear about it three times. There's some slight differences here and there in the different descriptions of them. And some of them are a little easier to understand than others. Some of them are very difficult to understand. Last time I gave class, I read one verse in the second canto where Lord Brahma is explaining some really technical aspects of the creation. Then he says to Narada, and you are very competent to understand all this. But when we read it, we may think, well, not I. It's difficult to understand. But it's all meant for our purification because it's Krishna's Leela. We can remember that. It's Krishna's Leela. And Krishna is Somehow coverings are coming off, our encrusted heart, the crusts are breaking off so that we can come to that point of bhava where we faint in ecstasy and hearing Krishna's name and Krishna Katha. So it's all part of the training, actually. Bhagavatam is all meant to train us, to bring us to that highest level where we can relish. It's interesting. I find it interesting that we're told we're not supposed to enjoy. We're servants. We're not meant to enjoy. But we find all over the place where we're meant to relish Krishna, actually. Relish Krishna Katha. The devotees enjoy like anything. And they're actually told to do it. It's not discouraged. You're encouraged. Just this verse of Pibata Bhagavatam Rasamat. Drink this nectar over and over and over again. Don't be shy about it. Enjoy Krishna Katha. Don't think, oh, this is sense gratification. No. Well, it is, but for our spiritual senses. So the Bhagavatam is there, and we're encouraged to do it. And of course, what does that do for us? It helps us rise above trying to enjoy the dull. Prabhupada used to sometimes describe, he said, in the morning they're taking their biscuits and the tea, and what is it, dry dough? What is the taste? There's no taste, no flavor, just dry. But we're eating, you know, Maha Prasadam feast, and the Bhagavatam is like that. Multifaceted, multi-course feast. We're told to relish. Of course, we relish prasadam through the tongue and prasadam through the ear also. We're encouraged to do that. Get us out of this miserable existence in the material world. All right, let me read the verse again. I'll just read the translation. In the beginning, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead manifested the form of Brahma through the material mode of passion in order to create this universe. The Lord manifested his form as Vishnu, the Lord of sacrifice and protector of the twice-born brahmanas and their religious duties to maintain the universe. And when the universe is to be annihilated, the same Supreme Lord employs the material mode of ignorance and manifests the form of Rudra. The created living beings are thus always subject to the forces of creation, maintenance, and destruction. Any discussion? Let me look at the ladies. Any of the ladies today? Ragatmika Prabhu.
You were speaking of the modes of nature, so I recalled the other day in our discussion after Bhagavatam, there was a nice distinction made between enthusiasm and passion. In Upadeshamrita, Rupa Goswami cites how the patience, confidence, and enthusiasm are required. So the difference between passion and enthusiasm is that in this enthusiasm Rupa Goswami speaks of is tempered by patience, which is the mode of goodness.
Doesn't Prabhupada also use the phrase endeavor with intelligence? I always like that letter Prabhupada wrote to someone. He said, if you don't know, use your intelligence. If you don't have any, ask somebody who does. Talyapaniku?
The Prabhupada said that Lord Vishnu creates Brahma through the mode of passion. So this would imply that the mode of passion was existing before Brahma. So I'm just wondering, you know, normally we understand that Brahma had a universe in front of him which is without distinction, without subtle or gross form. So I'm wondering, when Mahavishnu, you know, breathes out the universe, this would imply that it's already imbued with these three qualities. Is that accurate, you think?
The modes of material nature, as I understand it, are present in the Mahatattva, which, you know, there are these different stages. There's the Pradhan. No, thank you. Pradhan. And then the modes of material nature, I think, are in the Mahatattva. So it says here, manifested through the mode of passion. So these things, they come together. We have, for example, the controlling deities of different senses, and they appear along with the senses, or like one after the other. So the same thing with this, the controlling deity of the mode of passion appears with the mode of passion. Well, here, it's the way it's stated here, it does say, through the mode of passion, in order to create this, well, his business is to create the universe. But that's, as I understand it, these modes of material nature, and they're agitated by the time factor, which is sometimes described as Krishna's glance. And then Brahma appears, and he unfolds the creation. Krishna gives the 16 constituents of matter, and then Lord Brahma uses those materials to create this material world. But we also know how does Brahma appear in the usual narrative that we hear. He appears from the navel of Lord Vishnu. So passion, yeah, I don't know. There are so many different. One thing is every day of creation. Krishna doesn't, because it's his leela, he doesn't always have to do it the same way. That's one reason why we get different descriptions. Each day of Brahma is called a kalpa. And the acharyas rely on this to explain when there are differences, the descriptions of different things. They just say, well, in a different kalpa, a different day of Brahma, he wakes up in the morning and says, well, I think I'll do it different today. That's his prerogative.
Thank you, Prabhu, for a wonderful class. Earlier, you were speaking of Mahavishnu performing this, for him, it's Leela versus a job. So Lord Brahma, you're saying, and Lord Shiva have the job of creation and destruction. But for Lord Vishnu and Krishna, obviously that it's Leela, or he gets to do it, he wants to do it. So, of course, we can't compare it to the Supreme Lord, but being his part and parcel, we also may have some similarities. So I'm just wondering, in my life or in our life, how we have this cyclical creation and destruction happening with, you know, Rajagun, Tamagun, you know, having to get up every morning, doing our duties, doing our job, our work. And it may be, you know, cumbersome, agitating. Okay, I have to do this. And then, things, like you said, but of ignorance, you leave it, you know, messes, you know, I have children, I know about them. So, but then the mode of goodness, as devotees, you know, we try to regulate our lives and surrender. So hopefully we get to some point where there's more maintenance or more goodness so that we can have a little bit of, not leela per se, but, you know, meditation on the Lord's leela, have some peace of mind. So I'm just wondering, you know, how to think about that in terms of, you know, being Thanksgiving today, being grateful for this chance to do my duty or do our duties, but in that consciousness of Leela Smaranam, or, you know, that I get to do this. I don't have to do this, but I get to do this. So what is that? For the human being, how does that translate, in other words?
The closer we get to our original relationship with Krishna, the freer we become. We have choices that other people don't have. They don't have the choice to go to Mangalarti because they never heard of Mangalarti. So it's not like they wake up in the morning thinking, should I go or not? The idea doesn't enter their minds. And of course, why is that? Because of just the choices they made in their past. Choices have consequences. So they have consequences for ourselves also. And we want to make the right choices. And the more often we make the right choices, the more opportunity we get to serve Krishna more directly. So it always comes down to hearing and chanting, really. How do we use our time? I've sometimes thought this, I hope it's not offensive to say this, but I used to hammer on the morning program back in the old days. Not so much anymore. But especially for devotees living in the temple. And the devotees wouldn't come to Mangalarti, even though they were living right in the temple, you know, right upstairs. And what I found that was that after a while, these devotees found themselves in complicated circumstances where they basically couldn't come to Mangalarati anymore. And I always felt that maybe there was a connection there. When they had the opportunity, they didn't do it. And then Krishna put him in a situation where it was much harder. Krishna said, all right, you don't want to come to Mangalarati, then I'll put you in a situation where you're too hard to come anymore. So I don't want to offend everyone who's not able to come to Mangalarati. But we have to, the point is, whatever situation we're in at the moment, we have to make the best of it. We have to use our opportunities that Krishna gives us. And then, even if you're talking about, of course, it takes, you might say it's a mode of passion to go to work every day. But regulation is also a good thing. In fact, I don't know how much you hear about these things, but our country is not in such great shape right now. And one reason is a lot of people just don't work. Huge percentage of people in this country live off welfare, government checks. It's like, I forget, I saw a figure, it was like 92 million households or some crazy thing, where no one in the house works. So no regulation. What do they do all day? They get intoxicated, they watch television, they, you know, mode of ignorance. So passion is good, actually. Prabhupada made an argument about, for the Gurukul in Dallas. He said, you tell people that, you know, they're all becoming hippies, non-productive. We'll make them productive American citizens without the way we'll teach them. We'll make them, ladies and gentlemen, carry on what you've built here in America. Basically, I'm just paraphrasing, but that's basically the idea that he made. So to be a productive member of society is better than sitting around all day and watching television and doing nothing. So that regulation, even though you might call it passion, it's good. It's stabilizing. And to do it day by day and maintain that, you're in touch with the mode of goodness. So that's good. And as we do that, of course, then we have to hear and meditate, and maybe we can be thinking, like the example that's given in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, I guess it comes from, yes, Lord Chaitanya and Sanatana Goswami, to just be like the wife with a paramour, always thinking of the paramour while she's doing her household duties really well. So you can do your work really well thinking, I'd rather be chanting Hare Krishna. Sometimes my mind says that I should have a t-shirt that says, I'd rather be somewhere else. You know? Even when I'm in the temple, my mind is thinking, what's the next thing I'm going to be doing? You know? But we should be somewhere else with a t-shirt that says, I'd rather be in kirtan. So in our work, we can carry that meditation with us also, that longing for when I can have more time, more opportunity to serve Krishna. That's purifying.
In the Upanishad, it also says one should cultivate knowledge and innocence side by side.
Well, it means to cultivate knowledge of knowledge and innocence, not to cultivate innocence.
Well, not to cultivate it in that sense, but you do have two aspects of your life. You have to maintain, like Krishna also says in the Gita, that one is not a renouncer or a sannyasi who lights no fire, performs no work. So one has to do something. And as you were pointing out, that depending on your consciousness, then you'll eventually diminish one and increase the other. But if you're not doing that, then maybe Krishna will make arrangements where you can't cultivate the other one. You know, you have a hard time going to Mangalarti and chanting around and so forth. But you have to be occupied with something. So if you're not going to be occupied with Krishna, then you have to be occupied with something else, which means that. My question in regards to the verse when Krishna says, I manifest like in Brahma and Shiva, that's not a personal manifestation. That's just his Shakti that he invests in Brahma and Shiva. It doesn't. Sometimes we know he becomes Brahma, but usually...
Yeah. Well, Brahma is different from Shiva. Shiva is an expansion of Sankarshan. We know how Shiva is sort of in between. So he deals directly with the material energy. His consort is Durga Devi, Parvati. So there's a close connection there, whereas Vishnu is separated, has more distance. So Shiva is he's God, but he's God touching the material energy. So he's an expansion in that way. And Lord Brahma, he's a jiva generally, but he's in a special position where he's empowered with the rajas. He controls the rajas. Sometimes it controls him a little bit, but
That's his body. Where there's one place that says, generally, I think it's in the second canto. Maybe Narada says it. But generally, our body is 7 cubits of the hand, if I think there's a way it's described. And then it says for Lord Brahma, the universe is 7 cubits of his hand. So he's basically all pervading. I always wonder, something I don't have an answer to, is how many people know what's going on in my mind? How many entities in this universe? Are they reading my thoughts right now? Does Indra know if I'm thinking about him? Or how does he even know if somebody's worshiping him? Is that intelligence all over the universe that he knows someone's worshiping him? Well, possibly Lord Brahma does, because he's pretty much pervades the universe with his consciousness. So anyway, he's a special person with great power, guna avatar. So these two words together, guna and avatar, you can practically say passion personified.
Do you feel comfortable? So 504,000 Indras come and go in the lifetime of one. Mm. And it's also stated with the mind. We might think the mind is in the head, but the mind emits waves, thought waves, and that can be read. You know, so there's so many different beings can actually read your mind, higher beings.
But I mean, do we know? Does it say anywhere that, for example, the devas can read all human beings? They can read their thoughts. They're doing that right now? I don't think so. They have better things to do. They're living in a sattva goon. They don't want to see everyone's thoughts. Yeah, prana. Oh, go ahead, madam.
It's just a little comment on the five commentaries of Vishnu Chakravarti.
Uh-huh.
And then I was thinking how Krishna, when he was talking to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he did Atmarama verse, which is similar, the idea of how the liberated soul can enjoy Krishna consciousness that we were talking about before, rasa. So then that was enough for Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya to understand that he's not human. This is Krishna himself. And then when he talked to Sanatana Goswami, another 61 varieties of the Atmarama verse out, each word. So, as you pointed out, it's unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
He was playing very nicely with Santana and he just kept going.
And give it to Prana. I just wanted to mention one thing. Here in this verse, it mentioned about, I'm not quite sure the significance of why this was mentioned, but about Garbhodakshaya, or Vishnu appearing as Suyagya. I think because the word Kratupati was here, the Lord of Sacrifice. But Vishnu appears as all the avatars. So anyway, Suyagya, the son of Prajapati, Ruchi. So this Suyagya became Indra. So here's one example where you have Vishnu Tattva becoming actually Lord Indra during the reign of Swayambhuva Manu.
I was thinking from a difference and related to your previous discussion about how Lord is Lilamai. And in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings, he says in Jaya Dharma that two things should be focused always in relation to the material creation, that the creator, designer, he has a purpose and he wanted to manifest his own merciful form, Kripamai, and he is always enjoying Lila. So these two has to be focused. And then I was thinking, like Jiva Goswami Pad gives an analogy that Krishna also has an interest for the material world. It's not just us. Why? Because Jiva Goswami Pad gives that in the prakosta or chamber in Golok Vrindavan, there is a many things to nourish the Lila in a conceptual form, not in actual physical form. Like for example, demon. There is no demon in Golok Vrindavan, but demon in a conceptual form is there. Mother Yashoda still feels like there is a witch, Uttana, and she grabbed Krishna and kissed it. But there is no putana in Golok Vrindavan. So in material nature, that conception becomes reality of physical. And so Krishna also has some interest to increase and nourish his lila. So that way can be also see.
Not only is the creation lila, but of course it's also a place where he performs lila.
Yeah.
And he performs special lilas here that he doesn't perform there. That's another reason for his desiring it. It and just shook the
desire. That verse, the Anugrahaya Bhaktanam, the Prabhupada quote that verse, Anugrahaya Bhaktanam. He performed this lila to attract so that he can display his merciful, how merciful nature. Because in Golok Vrindavan, Krishna really cannot show merciful nature of him. He is eternally merciful. So it says that in a broad daylight, if I have a flashlight, I mean, what can be so important of that flashlight? But if it is the darks, like material world, the flashlight is very important. So Krishna's mercy is more elaborately glorified in the material world than in the spiritual world.
That reminds me of the Christians. They, you know, we always accuse them of not having an answer to the problem of evil. One argument that they give is that because of good qualities are desirable, God wants to create them, but some of these qualities can't be manifest in heaven where everything is good. So like compassion and so on, you have to make a misery in the material world so that people can show compassion. Because it's a desirable thing. So that's one reason why God creates the misery here in this material world.
Regarding the omniscience of the demigods, as I understand it, it's not only Brahma who's omniscient. I believe that all demigods have a degree of omniscience in their area of concern. Like Yamaraj has to be omniscient, and because they don't have the same limitations of time and space that we have. They're not encased in a gross earthly form. They exist on a different dimension. And you know, in order to enact the law of karma, you have to be omniscient. And, you know, I understand there's a demigod, lesser demigod in charge of, you know, dandelions all over the universe. So, you know, he doesn't run around to each dandelion. He exists on a different dimension, and that's a kind of omniscience. So I understand it.
All right, let's stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.